Have you heard about Global Poker? Global Poker is the fastest growing card room in the US today, and it's available online at globalpoker.com. Global Poker is a social poker site that offers safe and secure cash out options by using their unique and patented sweepstakes model. Players can compete in big guaranteed tournaments, jackpot sit and goes, or cash games featuring Hold'em, Omaha, and even Crazy Pineapple. Don't wait. Check out Global Poker today.
Poker Stories is an audio series that features casual interviews with some of the game's best players and personalities. Each episode highlights a well-known figure in the poker world and dives deep into their favorite tales, both on and off the felt.
Hello and welcome to Poker Stories, a podcast brought to you by Card Player, the poker authority, and hosted by me, Julio Rodriguez. This is episode number 93, featuring Houston Curtis. Now, you won't find the name Houston Curtis on any of the poker leaderboard pages, but for a period of time at the height of the boom, he was among the biggest winners in poker. Houston came to LA to make it in music, but ended up in TV production, warming up crowds at Showtime at the Apollo before becoming an executive at MTV, while making a fortune producing backyard wrestling videos. By chance, he was placed next to Tobey Maguire one night while playing cards at the Commerce. The two hit it off, and before long, they were playing in and then setting up private high-stakes poker games. Now, these games were filled with the Hollywood elite, and were chronicled in Aaron Sorkin's movie Molly's Game, as well as the book it was based on. But according to Houston and his book, Billion Dollar Hollywood Heist, it was actually he and Toby, not Molly, who ran the game while it was in Los Angeles. Houston's book is filled with stories from those games, and he doesn't shy away from the brutal truth, both good and bad. While Molly's Game used pseudonyms for their characters, Houston named names, talking about his time playing with the likes of Nelly, David Schwimmer, director Todd Phillips, Don Cheadle, Jeffrey Katzenberg, John Landau, Matt Damon, Ben Affleck, and Leonardo DiCaprio. Anyway, that's enough intro. Here's my conversation with Houston Curtis. I'm here with Houston Curtis, not here physically, but via Skype. How's the weather over there in Phoenix?
Oh man, it's really hot.
Like, it's not too similar from Vegas.
Yeah, you get baked out here. It's not no humidity whatsoever, just dry heat.
Did you take to it pretty easily? I'm from Florida. I know you're from Illinois, and the first time I got to Vegas, I got a nosebleed. I couldn't handle it.
No, I actually I didn't notice I came out here a year ago around same time. It was actually in July, and I was shooting a music video in the desert, which I will never do again. And one guy passed out and had to go to the hospital and everything. But I didn't stay long enough to realize what the dry heat would do to you after about a month. And you start itching and really messes with your skin. And plus, doing a lot of card work, which I don't do professionally anymore as far as sleight of hand in under fire or in actual games, as they would say. But I'm still always doing sleight of hand because I now, teach game production and teach like magicians and stuff like that. Your hands get super dry. So you got to keep putting lotion on your hands if you're handling cards, so your card work will your hands will listen to you, so to speak.
Yeah, my wife, when she moved here, one of the elderly people in line at the grocery store gave her advice. She said, "Oh, you're new here. Make sure you wear gloves while you're driving, because your hands will get cracked up on the steering wheel." Anyway, as I mentioned, you are from Illinois. I just finished reading your book this week, and then reviewed it again last night. I was very interested in the Minnesota Fats story that you kind of just glaze over there.
Yeah.
I mean, not many kids get to meet Minnesota Fats.
No, right? My dad was one of these guys who, Just an interesting dude. He was a great guitar player, and he played, you know, over the years I'd hear these stories because he's a guy of few words, right? But I'd hear about how he played with George Jones and Conway Twitty and Mickey Gilley and Brenda Lee and all these big country stars. But he's a pipeliner. So he would travel all across the country, and he'd, you know, these pipeliners, they all play poker and they shoot pool, and you know, and they have lots of interesting people they meet along the way.
So this was in your blood.
Yeah, you know, and Dad used to take me down to this this place. I mean, I was so small. It was called Cody's Tavern, and it was in like the tough part of town. And I remember one day, this guy, he was introducing him to the other guys in the bar as his cousin. I had never met him before. And, you know, and I didn't really understand what was going on at the pool table, but I understood when we pulled up in a parking lot after a day of shooting pool, and this guy's chopping up a bunch of money with my dad, that they had some type of deal and there was some type of hustle going on. And then he said, which I think became like a famous line. I think he said, like, you always keep them dancing, kid, or something like that, which is something he went on to say a few times. And I'll never forget it, man. I'll never forget it. And I said, Dad, I didn't know you had a cousin. He's now that's Minnesota Fats, boy. And you know, it's not a name you forget.
Did you play guitar as well? You mentioned your dad played.
Yeah, I did. I started playing when I was like 4 or 5 years old, and you know, sitting on his lap.
Wasn't sure if you were the bassist or not. So you took? Did you take the band out to LA, or did you go to LA to find a band?
I used there was a school, the Grove School of Music, and Grove School of Music was kind of like almost like a finishing school for a lot of kids, like dudes who had gone to 4 years at, you know, Juilliard or Berkeley or whatever. You'd see a lot of them there, but you could also go there and just take basically it was like jamming a 4-year music major into 1 year. And I went and I was studying the guitar program and the songwriting program. And, you know, your teachers are literally guys who are major pros working in the industry, kind of like MI, Musicians Institute, does has done for years as well. So that was kind of my excuse to get there. And I went with two guys that I played in a band with who are two of my best friends from, you know, growing up in Southern Illinois. And, you know, that was the way we kind of. That was our ticket out of the Midwest, was going to a 1-year music school in Los Angeles. And then from there, it was,
What's the name of your band?
Are you ready for this? Fortress Stronghold of Rock. And,
I like that.
You know, this is like 1986-ish. I graduated in 89. And then right at the tail end there, before I moved out to LA, I was in another band called Bad Manners. So, and then I came out to LA and formed a band, with, the guys that I, you know, had been playing with. And there was another guy from Texas and one guy from California. And, we were, I think at one point we were called Line 7, which was like a kind of a vague, not very well-known music term. And then we changed the name to Mind Over Matter. And
was this hair metal?
So you got to think, it's 1989 is when I left. So by the time I was in Mind Over Matter, it was like 91. And we were kind of a progressive, almost like a Dream Theater meets Kansas. And then all of a sudden, we got us a little development deal with Warner Brothers, and it was exciting. And here comes Pearl Jam and Nirvana, and the entire the entire industry changed.
So is the music out there? Can we find it?
Oh my God, I hope you don't.
We're gonna put it into the podcast so people can hear it.
Oh my God, there's a 45 I recorded when I was 15 in the Fortress band that a bunch of my friends from back home still have copies, and I don't even have a copy. I don't think this was long before the internet, so good luck with that one, my friend.
All right, so when did the music dream die and then turn the TV?
I don't know that it ever died. What happened was I got a gig playing guitar for Showtime at the Apollo. You remember that TV show?
Yeah, of course.
And, you know, it was shot in New York, obviously, at the Apollo, the famous Apollo Theater. But the show was produced by a gentleman named Bob Banner. And Bob was a legend. Bob was old back in like 92, you know. this is a guy who created the Carol Burnett Show, the Jimmy Dean Show, the Dinah Shore Show, the Gary Moore Show, and then Star Search, Solid Gold, tons of big variety shows. And they needed a guy to do sound-alikes. They had a segment in the show called A Tribute to an Apollo Legend. And they would hire me and pay me, like $50 to come in, and they'd do the segment was like, it's called the Apollo Minute. And like one week's tribute was like Bob Marley. The next week could be the Pointer Sisters. The next week could be Aretha Franklin. And they didn't want to pay the license fee to use the actual music. So they did soundalikes, and I got hired to play the soundalikes.
Mm-hmm.
And,
the Kids Bop version.
Yeah. You know, and, I'm like, hey, I'm now a professional in the music industry. I'm getting paid. But it wasn't enough to live on. And Bob ended up hiring me to work for his production company as a PA. And that's really how I got into the television business, you know. Right. And like by the time I was 23, I had landed on a couple different shows. And there was this one producer named Bert Dubrow who created the Sally Jesse Raphael Show and the Jerry Springer Show. And he was doing a talk show in Los Angeles. And the reason Bert liked me, now you got to remember back then, I didn't show many people anything I could ever do with a deck of cards. Cause I, if you read the book, you know, I kind of kept that part of my, my skill set, quiet ever since I read, you know, Expert at the Card Table when I was like 11, and I quit performing magic in front of people. And, but Bert was a huge magic fan, and he, was always talking about magic. And I said, I could do a few tricks for you sometime, Bert. And so I did. And then next thing you know, he's like, you're going to do audience warm up tomorrow. I want you to get 5 tricks ready and get some jokes. And I'm like, what? He's like, yeah, I'm going to double your pay. You're going to be great. And so he throws me out in front of the audience, and next thing I know, I'm doing audience warm up and stuff like that, which was fun. But that got me in the TV business. And by the time that show was over, I was, you know, shooting man on the street interviews and segment producing, and that led to a bigger show and a bigger show. Hell, I've produced the Jerry Springer Show. I went to Chicago and did that for Bert for a while. And then my TV career just kind of kept rising after that.
Well, I want to get to the poker, but let's talk about the TV first, because you're the guy behind Backyard Wrestling, right?
That's right.
I mean, how did that work? I mean, you weren't going around recruiting kids to fight each other in their yards. This was like a compilation kind of thing?
Yeah, it was a nice little period in history, right? YouTube did not exist. Okay, so you might remember, well, you may be too young to remember, but this was like, we're jumping ahead a little bit to like 98, 99.
Freshman year of high school.
Okay.
So this was right in my wheelhouse.
Okay, there you go. So I was an exec at MTV, and I was one of the very first guys that ever saw the first demo tape of Jackass, where, you know, Johnny Knoxville got shot in the chest and all that stuff. And I was like, man, this is great television. And there was one little local news channel that had ran this little piece on kids wrestling in their backyards and how violent it was. Now, I've been a wrestling fan from the time I was, you know, a small child as well. I grew up watching Wrestling at the Chase on Channel 11 out of St. Louis. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's back when all the wrestling promotions were kind of local, you know, or they were split up by territory back then before Vince McMahon ran everything. And I thought, man, it would be great to get a bunch of this backyard wrestling footage. It's kind of like the Jackass stuff I was thinking. So I found out all these little fuckers had websites. Now, they couldn't post their video up because there wasn't a platform for it yet, right? Like, YouTube didn't exist, and, you know, just streaming video wasn't a thing then. It wasn't a big thing anyway. So I started sending them all emails from my MTV email address, right? So these kids are getting an email from, like, HoustonCurtis@MTV.com. And
big shot.
Yeah. And I'm like, hey, it's Houston Curtis from MTV. I'm putting together a video called The Best of Backyard Wrestling. I would love to look at your footage and see if you make the cut. And I got a P.O. box. And before you know it, you know, just the tapes were flooding in. And me and my buddy Rick Marr, who actually lives out in Vegas, Rick produces a lot of big pay-per-view events out there. I convinced him to move. We'd been friends since kindergarten, and I convinced Rick to move to L.A. He quit. He had like a Fortune 500 job working for Kraft Food. So he left the cheese behind, and him and I were sitting there for hours. We'd be watching these kids jumping on trampolines and doing stupid, silly shit. And then about an hour, 45 minutes in, you know, little Johnny goes up on top of mom and dad's roof. Wraps himself in barbed wire, gets some lighter fluid, you know, lights a table on
normal
fire.
Kid stuff.
Yeah, jumps through it with, you know, thumbtacks and razor wire, and we're like, booyah, that clip will make it onto the video. And then we spent, you know, like a year really making these videos. We put together four of them before we released one, so we'd be ready, because we just had this feeling it was going to be big.
They're going to want volume two.
Exactly. You know, so it became, you know, volume one, I think we called it Future Kings of the Ring. And then volume two was more hardcore than ever before. Volume three, too shocking for TV. Volume four, random acts of violence. You know, and it just kept getting nuttier. And we did the late night TV ads, which took me a while to figure out, you know, the direct marketing methodologies. So I kind of went to DRTV school, and once we cracked it, I'll never forget, I still had a day job at that time. I'd left MTV and I was running development for Vin DeBona, the guy who created America's Funniest Home Videos. And I got a call from Rick, and he said, I just got the numbers from the ad last night. We had ran an ad on the Howard Stern show. He had a show on the E Network, and I was all prepared for disappointment. And I'm like, how do we do? He's like, we're going to be rich. And I said, what? Quit messing with me. How do we do? So it was like a $2,000 ad that brought in like $8,000 off of one ad. So then the goal was to buy as many ads as we could. So we parlayed.
4x your money.
Yeah. So we took all of our money, reinvested it. And we got to where we got up to about a $50,000 a week ad spend. And we couldn't really spend more than that because we couldn't find more places to clear the ad because the ad was so damn violent and crazy.
Yeah, this is like late night advertising alongside Girls Gone Wild and stuff, right?
Yeah. Matter of fact, I'll send you a copy of the original commercial. It's funny.
Attention, stay tuned for a special TV offer.
Your discretion is advised.
The best of backyard wrestling has been banned from television. Secret underground fight clubs are risking their lives, and we have it all caught on tape. This wild footage is so extreme, we can't even show it to you in this commercial.
And then that turned into an entire direct-to-video franchise business where we did ghetto brawls and brawling broads and world's wildest street fights. You know, the bum hunter guys came to us, wanting us to distribute. We ended up passing, but there was our own kind of, I think it was a bum. We did a side video with the bum hunter who was in bum fights. You know, it was a bunch of that just young guy, ruckus video stuff. And we had a lot of success with it. It was crazy.
Yeah, that made you a millionaire.
Yes, it did.
Was that when you kind of decided to start splashing around at the Commerce?
No, man. I'd been splashing around the Commerce. I splashed around the Hollywood Park probably from... I'd been playing since the early 90s, as soon as I got into L.A. Mm-hmm.
Well, then that's kind of my main question. What attracts you to poker at that time, you know, well before the poker boom had made it a household game?
Yeah, so I became enamored with poker and sleight of hand on the same day. And I talk about this in my book. I was watching my dad. I kind of like the way I watched him shoot pool with Minnesota Mats. I was watching him with some buddies and they were playing poker. And I just been watching all, night. And my dad was kind of like, when you're like 5 years old or 6 years old, your dad's your hero, right? Mm-hmm. And he was gone a lot. So when he was home, I liked to hang out with him. And he'd sit me on his lap and just let me watch the hands and stuff. And then he had to go take a phone call or something. And I ended up playing the hands. I'd never been taught the game. And, this is in the friggin' 70s or whatever. So they were playing five card draw and five card stud. And I figured it out, and I won a big pot while he was on a call, and which he got a big kick out of. And then at the end of the night, he said, well, let me show you something. And he showed me this magic trick where I picked a card he put the card back in the deck, set the deck on the table, and then he smashed his hand on top of the deck and put his other hand under the table. And wouldn't you know it, the card magically went through the table and ended up in his other hand. And as a little kid, I was like, I was hooked. I was fascinated.
Get me today.
So at that moment, I became, really, I fell in love with two things, poker and magic. But it wasn't until I was reading this book called The Amateur Magician's Handbook, and it was written by a guy named Henry Hay, and it had all the like tricks that like how to levitate a woman or how to saw a woman in half, like all that cool stuff was in there. But I was more interested in the the card manipulation, the sleight of hand. And then it started talking about this one move called the bottom deal, and I was like, oh, what's this? And Hay, in his book, he said, this isn't really a magician's move. This is more of a gambling move. And he went on to refer to a book called The Expert at the Card Table. Well, right away, I was like, wait a minute. I could learn to do this move, and I could deal myself the winner. And, so I loved poker, and I loved magic. So I was on the hunt for this book, and I had this romantic notion in my mind of being like one of these, turn of the century riverboat gambling, Wild Bill Hickok type dudes who could go in, and just beat anybody playing poker. And I think I was 11 before I ever found the book, because we didn't have Amazon back then. And the book was written in 1902 by a guy named S.W. Erdnase, which wasn't his real name. He was a professional card cheat. And basically what he did is he put his life's work into this book. And that book became the Bible for card magic. And not just card cheating, but actually, some of the most used moves in card magic today came from that book. And historically, the greatest, some of the greatest magicians, card magicians, will tell you that all of the greatest moves for doing, really impressive card magic came from the card table, came from guys who were professional card cheats. And that term used to not even be used. It used to just be called professional gamblers. If you're a professional gambler, you were a card cheat. Otherwise, you were just a gambler.
Right. It's 1900s. There's a separation in the poker world that happened when the modernization of the game happened, I think.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And, Doyle will talk about it. He talks about it in his book. But, sure. The rules weren't the rules for a while.
Oh, yeah. And Doyle lived through those times. And you know, look, I love hearing, you know, stories from guys like Doyle. What I would really love to hear is the stories that Doyle hasn't told.
And exactly.
And the stories he probably never will tell. Because, you know, guys like him and Slim and Sailor Roberts, if you don't think that those guys were sharp, you know, traveling from town to town, I mean, they not only had to know every trick in the book to be able to detect it, you know, they had to be very smooth in getting in and out of these games. And I'm sure they knew a lot of things that, you know, a lot of secrets that they probably put away a long time ago when poker became super popular and the fish, you know, started coming in droves.
Mm-hmm. Well, then let's talk about you're playing poker in LA. You're doing well, moving up in stakes, or is this just a matter of, you know, your day job is treating you well and you want to feel that rush, so you move up in stakes?
I wanted to get, you know, I had been playing poker since, you know, I was a kid, but it was like, you know, poker with my buddies in the basement of the church on Sundays, you know, poker at someone's house. You know, I grew up in a small town. There was no casinos anywhere near me, right? So I loved the idea of being able to go into a licensed card room and play. And I didn't know what to expect at first. I didn't even realize there was going to be one person dealing the cards. I thought it'd be, you know, they'd be passing the deal.
Self-deal, yeah.
Yeah, which they actually did do up until, what, the 80s, I think?
Yeah.
You know, even the card rooms in California, it used to be past the deal, and in Vegas.
I think they were doing it in Texas recently.
Yeah. There's a lot going on in Texas with poker, but we can talk about that later. But yeah, I walked in and just wanting to learn Hold'em. Now, I had played a little bit of Hold'em. I knew about the game, but it was never, you know, that popular. I mean, we're talking like 91 or whatever when I started playing. It was popular, obviously, but it hadn't reached me in a big way. I was still playing 7-card stud and 5-card draw and all kinds of variations. So I started out at the low limit, like it was literally $1 table, and it smelled so bad, dude. just the smell of, you know, the scumbaggery and the bums when you walked into the Hollywood Park. I began to really enjoy it. Like, if I hadn't been away a while, you know, or if I'd been away a while, you walk in and you just, I'd take a deep breath and I'd be like, ah, you can just smell the scumbag in the air, you know? And it was like urine over those low limit tables. And so I quickly moved to 3-6 or 2-4, then 3-6, and then 6-12 limit. And I sat at 6-12 limit for like probably a year or so, just kind of looking over at the ropes on the other side. You know, on the other side of the ropes, there was one 10-20 game. Then there was like two or three 15-30 games, which I don't know why there was only one 10-20, but that's how it was then. And then you'd have the Omaha, and there was one table in the very back, and I wasn't quite sure what they were doing. All right. And the first time I moved over to 10-20, I like literally I made like three racks of chips doing 3-6. So I thought I was killing it. And then I went over to 10-20. I lost everything in like 20 minutes.
Yeah. Quick education.
Yeah. But I won really, I was up, I ended up moving up to 15-30, and I cashed out for a few thousand one night. And there's this guy in the back, his name was Ron. He said, hey, as I was walking up to the cage to cash out, he said, hey, why don't you come check out Pot Limit? And ooh. I was like, oh, tell me about Pot Limit. And they were playing 5-5 blind Pot Limit. And, there was no limit games weren't a thing yet, you know? That's where I really, I think, became a good poker player, if I would even call myself that, was from playing with those guys. There were some really good players that played there. And, you know, Sharon Goldman and her husband, Dan Goldman, you know, Sharon the poker pro. And mm-hmm. I think Dan works for, he's a big poker executive. And they were regulars in the game. And this guy named Nick DeLeo, he was a pro, and you know, and I played in that game for years while I was also playing in all kinds of side games around Hollywood and dealing with some of those games. Yeah.
All right, well, we're going to have to fast forward a bit. So to meeting Toby, you walk into the Commerce and the floor randomly puts him next to you or puts you next to him in a game. He ends up liking you, and then all of a sudden you two hit it off.
Yeah, I had literally walked through the doors straight. I didn't even say hi to anyone. I was just walking straight back to the board at the high limit section. And I don't even know if I got to the board. I think one of the guys saw me as I was walking to the board and just kind of steered me over to a seat and just set me down right next to Toby. And yeah, we played all night, and we knew a lot of the same people. And, you know, he was soaking the game up like a sponge, and some of the guys were talking about that. But what really fascinated me was to see how these guys acted around a celebrity. And at that point, you know, this is a little later on, I'd become, you know, I was already self-made guy, I was successful, and, you know, I certainly had dealt with plenty of celebrities, you know.
You weren't starstruck.
I wasn't, and that was never really my thing anyway. But unless I saw, like, you know, Eddie Van Halen or something like that. You know what I mean? I saw Steve Perry at a car wash once, and I was such a Journey fan. I talked to him for an hour. He just was looking at my car. I had the CLX or CL65 AMG Mercedes. He's looking at it, and he gives me a Journey disc. He said, "We just mixed it. It was live from Houston."
Jeez.
And I didn't even think to get a picture or ask him to autograph it. That's how Star Search started. Yeah.
What was it, 81 or?
Well, they had just done a remix. This was in like 2000. This is after I knew Affleck and Toby and DiCaprio and all those guys.
No, I meant when the concert was, yeah.
Oh, yeah. It was in the 80s. Yeah, it was that 80s concert live from Houston. And man, I love Journey. But anyway, I wasn't really the starstruck type. And we started talking, and I told him about this game I was playing in at this guy named Reagan Silber's house. Reagan was a guy from Texas who had made millions as a class action attorney. Then he invested in a tech stock that went through the roof, and he came out to Hollywood to, you know, live the Hollywood dream. You know, he's going to get into the movie business or the entertainment business of some kind. You know, this beautiful house in the Hollywood Hills. And so a bunch of my buddies who are in the industry had been going to this game, and I told Toby about it. And the next week Toby shows up to the game. And then after that, Toby invited me to his game at his house. And I'd say after we played together for like three times, you know, we just started hanging out at the end of every night, talking about the game, talking about how to make it bigger, talking about the kind of people to invite. And we just had the same mindset that there a lot of real money could be made. And, you know, we kind of put together an, you know, unofficial type of little business plan and just started doing it. And the game just started growing, you know, rapidly.
I guess this is where we should start talking about Molly Bloom. Obviously, for the people listening at home who have probably seen Molly's game by this point, or maybe even read her book, you know, in your book, Billion Dollar Hollywood Heist, by the way, go check it out. You say nice things about Molly, but clearly you disagree as to who started and structured these games.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's just, it's a fact, you know. So the movie takes even more creative liberty than she did in her book. You know, me and Toby had this game going before Molly ever came into the picture. Mm-hmm. And the problem was, it was at his house, and the money kept getting bigger and bigger. So, A, we were worried about guys literally, like, getting mugged, you know, or carjacked leaving his house. He didn't want to be a part of anything like that that might have gone down. And more importantly, he was a little eccentric. And you had guys, you know, ordering pepperoni pizza. And, you know, this one guy, Kevin Washington, whose father's like a Montana billionaire, he was he was spitting tobacco into one of Toby's cups. And Toby, you know, at the end of that night, he's like, dude, I can't take it anymore. I've got to get these scumbags out of my house. Where can we play? And we started talking about it, and we're like, dude, why don't we call Feinstein? Our buddy Darren Feinstein owned the Viper Room. He had bought it from Johnny Depp.
Now, in the movie, he's Dean?
Yeah, in the movie, he's Dean.
Mm-hmm.
And and in the movie, I'm Harlan Huestis, who, you know, they rewrote it to where I wasn't even a part of the game when it started, right?
Right. Like, they basically said Toby pulled you in off the street halfway through the game running, maybe to stake you. It's insinuated. And then, no, that's basically the first half of the movie is LA, and the second half is New York, which doesn't involve you guys.
Right, right. Until the end, when she
gave
me one last dig and said Harlan Huestis is in jail and blah blah blah. That was at the end of the movie. What's funny is when Molly gave her deposition to the feds, my name just happened to be the very first one on the list. when she was talking about the very first time she ever saw a poker game in her life. She named all the players there, including, you know, of course, me and Toby, who came together.
Mm. Okay, so the game's not going down well for Toby at his house. So Darren Feinstein invites you guys over to the Viper Room, and she is his assistant and basically helps keep tabs on the buy-ins.
Yeah, Darren says, look, I've got this girl Molly, she'll serve drinks, she's really cute, and blah, blah, blah. We're like, great, sounds great. Because Toby didn't want it to be known as his game either, you know. It just didn't look good. She had a kind of a quick education on, you know, poker. I mean, she never really learned the game, but she kind of learned, you know, she learned everyone's drink order, put that way, got everyone's phone numbers. And then at one point, her and Darren got into it. Got into some type of disagreement, and she came crying to a guy in the game that she was dating at the time, which in the movie says she didn't, you know, have any relations with any other players, which I won't comment much on that, but I just thought that was funny. And anyway, and so he came to me and Toby and said, hey, you know, Darren's starting to take a game away from her. We're going to have it at my house tonight. And then she talked to us afterwards. And we're like, okay, yeah, you can keep the game. And this is where, you know, Toby starts thinking, let's kick it up a notch. And I didn't want to kick it up a notch because, you know, I got to tell you, there was a brilliance to our whole plan at the Viper Room game. And maybe something that just could have only been done during that particular time in history because so many people were new to poker. What we did was it was 100, 200 blinds at the beginning. This is before it went up higher. And the buy-in was only $5,000. Now, anyone who plays cash game poker knows that you can't sit right in a 100, 200 game with only $5,000 if you're going to play poker all night.
Yeah, it's only 25 big blinds.
Yeah, so
you're basically three bet shoving.
Exactly. And so what would happen is all these guys would be like, wait a minute, you mean I get to sit with Leonardo DiCaprio, Tobey Maguire, all these celebrities and play poker, and all I gotta risk is $5,000? I'm in. And it was beautiful, man. And like before the button made it by one orbit, you'd have guys who had already bought back in twice.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah. Well, who wants to go home after 10 minutes if you're sitting across the table from movie stars?
Exactly. And it's not like they couldn't afford it. We knew they could. It wasn't like we were inviting, you know, some grinder with his last $5,000 in a dream. You know, these were like successful guys. And we knew that it would be embarrassing for them to lose $5,000 in 5 minutes and then get up and leave. And you know, and it worked out beautifully. So I never wanted to see that end, but Toby was ready to, he thought maybe it'll work the same way, only on a bigger level. So we kicked the blinds up to 200, 400 and made a 50K buy-in. And the game got, and then, you know, Molly's big, kind of directive at that point was, you find the hotels, you book it. We don't want to have to deal with it. And you call the players, you know, but every player was, you know, at this point, well, at all points through the game were approved, by the guys in the game, specifically Toby, you know, and me and Toby would, you know, he would discuss any decisions he was vacillating on with me and we'd make a call. So her job is pretty easy and she was making, you know, there was no rake. We never raked the game. Tipping was encouraged. And
right. If you want to get invited back, you got to tip Molly.
Yeah. Right? And that actually started in Toby's house with his girlfriend who later became his wife, who's now his ex, Jen Meyer. Cause Jen would deal and that's how it went down there. And Darren had heard Toby say that a million times. If you want to get invited back, you got to make sure and tip Jen. And so when Molly, you know, hosted the game the first night, you know, Darren repeated those words that he had heard Toby say. And, but all of a sudden, you know, these guys that were playing were so huge. Like we got this guy, Larry Hahn, who this is the guy who created the, fake perfume empire. You know, those, the hustlers in New York, hey, if you like Chanel number 5, you'll love this and you can get it for $2.
you like those white diamonds? This is a blue sapphire.
Yeah. And so he like created that business and he was worth, you know, like $300-400 million. And he was really, he was a nice guy. And I always thought it was funny that Todd Phillips, who played in the game, who directed the old school and the Hangover and just did the Joker. Todd was super funny. And he'd always call Larry Old Spice because he was old and, you know, and he did perfume and he would threaten to bang his wife. He had this wife who was like 30. It was so funny. Every time I struck in, hey, Larry, you wouldn't mind if I bang your wife, do you? Don't say that, Todd. That's not nice.
So these guys are big tippers, and basically, you know, Molly's walking away with a big chunk of what Toby perceives to be his potential winnings.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, me and Toby were crushing it. We were winning, and I was just happy to be there. You know what I mean? And we were winning a lot of money, but. You know, when you got guys who start losing six figures a night, which was the way it was out of the gate with that, you know, once we went to the hotels, and she's taken 30 a night and, you know, and also the dealer, who doesn't get mentioned a lot in the story, but he was a big part of it. Manny, the dealer, for the longest time they were splitting it. So whatever Molly would get, Manny would get tipped the same. And people just tended to do that. They would tip Molly and Manny, and they would usually give Molly the same amount that they gave Manny. And later on, I think Molly, you know, without telling me and Toby, she got a little greedy and started threatening Manny's, you know, job and started making him give her some of his tips as well. And it took him a while to fess up to me because he didn't want to rock the boat because, you know, he'd bought 3 houses at that point. I mean, we were making both of these people rich. And you know, the games got bigger and people get greedier, you know, but some of the guys who played in this game, man, like I saw Larry Hahn once tip, Chuck Pacheco's in a hand with him. And, it was like straight over straight and it busted Chuck for like 25 grand. And Chuck's like, oh man, Larry, I just sit down. I can't believe you rivered me like that. And Larry says, oh, I feel bad about that, Chuck, here. And he hands him back the 25 grand. and Chuck turned to me. He's like, hey, look, Houston, Larry just gave me a Prius.
And that's great.
And that's how it was, man. It was just wild. And guys who they'd lose 6 figures and still tip 10 grand at the end of the night. Mm-hmm. It was just bizarre.
Well, I think that's where the movie kind of loses some of the hardcore poker audience in building some, because the movie does paint a very sympathetic picture of Molly. Obviously, you know, she grew up with two overachieving brothers, and she had the injury that kept her out of the Olympics, and her dad was an asshole. And obviously, all the stuff that happened in New York was very unfortunate with the mobsters there. But to have her game taken away from her just seems like business to me. The movie tries to make Toby out to be some monster for simply taking his business elsewhere where the rake was a little cheaper. I mean, you can call it tips, but it's money right. coming out of the game, you know?
Well, first of all,
what's the difference between that and going down the street to a different casino?
Oh, nothing, but it became personal, right? Because we were all, you know, friends. Mm-hmm. But in that respect, what really was upsetting when I saw the movie and in her book was the way it was portrayed that the game was taken away from her. Because what really happened was this guy, New York Cliff, who played huge, and he was in a big game that we all knew about in New York, and this game had been going on longer than ours had with all these like Wall Street guys. And it was disorganized. It wasn't organized like we were. He would come and play with us every now and then. And he really put the heat on. I mean, the night that he came, that particular night, I remember Bob Safai had to call him on an $800,000 bluff. and Bobby doesn't shake it much, but his hand was shaking when the river came off on that one. And he won it. And, you know, and New York Cliff just kind of, you know, shrugged it off. Like, oh, I was trying to get you. But at the end of the night, Molly knew her days were numbered, and because Alec Gores, the billionaire, had been playing with us, and he had just finished his 50,000 square foot home and built his own world class poker room in it, sitting right next to a 3-story wine cellar, you know, and he wanted to show it off, right? And so Toby and I. And Molly walk up to the little bar area after the game with Cliff. And he's like, I want you to, Cliff, you should consider having Molly come to New York and run your game. And that's how she got the New York game. It was handed to her on a silver platter, you know? So, you know, here's this guy, Toby, who made her rich. I mean, beyond her wildest dreams. And then continues to make her rich by saying, hey, it wasn't just like, hey, we got to move our game over to Alex and you're screwed. It was like, hey, we're moving our game over to Alex, but let me give you this giant gift. You know, let me give you a game that plays as big or if not bigger in New York, that's totally disorganized and you can go be the queen. And that's what we gave her. And, you know, not only did she muck it all up when she was on her own and didn't have guys, you know, to really run things by, she gets involved with the wrong people and, you know, everything goes to shit. But to make Toby come off like the asshole and all that, I think it's been damaging to the guy's career, whether he'll ever admit it or not. And it's just flat out wrong. It wasn't what happened. So,
well, let's talk about Toby for a second. I'm a fan, you know, that stretch she did in the late 90s with ending with Wonder Boys. Wonder Boys is one of my favorite movies ever. Cider House Rules, Pleasantville. Great actor.
Seabiscuit is one of my all-time favorite films.
You know, I didn't meet Toby, but I did see him in 2006, which was my first year at the World Series of Poker.
Okay.
And I actually thought he was hanging out with Johnny Drama, Kevin Dillon. But it was turned out to be Chuck Pacheco, who looks a lot like him.
I was with him too. I was there too.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah. Yes, but you know, Toby was very guarded. He did not want his photo taken, did not want to talk to anybody. So I understand why he would be drawn to a private game. What's hard to wrap my mind around is why this multimillionaire cared so much about winning, you know, tens of thousands and eventually millions of dollars from his actor friends and, you know, hedge fund friends and the like. You know, the movie and your book paint a portrait. He says he lived to beat people out of their money. Money won was twice as sweet as money earned. I mean, is that a fair characterization, like, of who he was as a guy?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he was very competitive, you know. And look, if you look back at interviews with Toby, he doesn't do a lot. But I remember seeing one interview where they talk about the first time he ever met Leo. And one of the things he says in the interview is, you know, he was this guy there taking it very serious. And he sees this other kid, because they were just kids, you know, being goofy and just being a kid. And I think it was maybe Jimmy Kimmel. He's like, so what'd you think about him? He's like, well, I was sizing up the competition. You know, that's how Toby looked at things, mm-hmm. you yeah. know, and you can call it, you know, when all of a sudden you become a personality or a famous person, then your character traits all of a sudden become character flaws. You know, we all know people who are competitive. We all know people who are lazy. We know people who are, you know, funny or dull. But we don't judge how we're going to look at them overall as a person by one of those traits, you know? And I think because of, you know, how famous Toby was, he becomes an easy target to pick on, you know? But could you say he's a dick? Yeah, you can say that, you know, you can say that, but I never met a fan that did ask him for a photo that he didn't give it to. I never met someone who asked him for an autograph that he didn't give it to.
Yeah, and I don't want to spoil your book, but there are countless instances of his generosity and kindness that you report on in the actual book itself.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think for most people, poker is like a means to an end. They all want to win the main event and then never have to pick up the deck again, you know. So, you know, you know, the way it's portrayed is that the two of you put this game together to fleece your friends, which is like, why not just sit back and enjoy a friendly poker game? Why not just head down to the Commerce like he did before? And
you know, okay. Are you really asking me that question?
Well, I'm trying, just trying to get some insight.
Think about it. First of all, I was happy to not have to walk back into Hollywood Park and smell the scumbaggery for a while.
Oh, of course. The game was soft and the money was big and, you know, it was great for you.
I mean, look, if anyone ever asks me for poker advice, which not a lot of people do, but some people do, and I'll tell them. And I, to this day, I think this is some of the best advice that you'll ever hear from anyone. I don't care what record they have playing poker. Game selection is mm-hmm. everything. And we had created like a little maze that they couldn't get out of. You know, these guys were never going to get any better and we're never going to run out of money. And look, if you love poker, tell me that that's not a game you wouldn't want to play in every week.
Yeah.
You know? And we loved the game. We would talk for hours about the game. We would sit and play heads up and just discuss the game. You know, he was just as passionate about poker as anyone who reads Poker Player or Card Player, you know, just loved it. And, you know, and he couldn't go out in public a lot because he would get so harassed and he didn't want to have to be an asshole out in public. You know, he didn't want to be the guy who started like pulling a Justin Bieber or something and like telling a fan to screw off. So he just tried not to go out in public a lot. And you got to remember, this is during the time of Spider-Man. So he was at the height of his celebrity, right? He couldn't go anywhere without getting noticed then. So it made it, you know, being in places like the Four Seasons and the Beverly Hills Hotel and playing with people who were very wealthy and, you know, discreet, was perfect. It was the perfect scenario for a guy who is basically like any type of Commerce hood rat, jonesing for some cards and then some action. You know, he loved the action like anyone else. But that was the you know, the setting, and the setting just happened to be very, very profitable.
In the book, you said that Toby won about $1 million a month for about 3 years. That would put him among one of the biggest poker winners of all time.
Yeah, definitely.
So, I mean, like, you stand by it, huh?
Tobey Maguire made...
That's a crazy claim. $36 million?
Yeah. That's about right.
That's bonkers. I mean, like, just to give the people listening at home some context to how big these games played.
Yeah, and I probably grossed, $15 million, but I was funding my entire life and operation and business, mm-hmm. With this money, whereas Toby was just put it in this little side account. It was like his poker winnings account.
Yeah, exactly. And obviously, the book highlights some of the struggles that came towards the end of this run for you, legally and health-wise. Let's see here. I got some rapid-fire questions because I don't want to give away too much of your book or the story. I want people to go out and read it. It's a fascinating read, Billion Dollar Hollywood Heist. But I do want to get some stories out of you, so here you go.
Yeah.
What's the reaction you've gotten from some of the people you mentioned by name in the book? I mean, because the biggest problem with Molly's Game is that there's really only four names named, and you went ahead and named everybody. Well, yeah. Most everybody. Have you been threatened at all by anybody because of this, or?
No.
Are you worried about any backlash?
No, I mean, look, Rick Solomon, called, and he loved the book. He said, I love it. I think it should be a movie, I talked to Rick.
You say some funny stuff about Rick.
Oh yeah, I tell the truth about Rick. But Rick is a proponent of the truth, And that's one thing I always respected about him. This is a guy who, if I shook his hand on any amount of money, you could guarantee that money was gonna be there the next day. He has integrity, You call him, a womanizer or a look, he'll be the first person to tell you, I was off the rails crazy then, doing cocaine. He doesn't run from the truth. So I didn't think I'd have a problem being truthful about, the fact that he did like 20 lines of blow that night that he one-outed me on the river for $1 million,
We'll get to that story.
He's a good guy. I really like Rick. And if I was going to lose that kind of money to anyone, I'm glad it was him. There's some guys that would have kept me up at night much, much longer, and just losing it in general was bad enough. But, and then there's other guys that, look, Ruderman, I don't give a shit what he says. He's this is the guy who was stealing from,
right, the Ponzi scheme guy who basically brought everything down.
Yeah. And it's so funny. I saw it wasn't on Amazon, but it was on Barnes & Noble. There was this this review, and it's from this guy. And he starts talking, and it seems like, man, this person seems like they really are. This must be somebody I know. And he's saying such specific things in great detail, and then gives it a 1-star. And then I look at the name, is like Bradley somebody. Oh yeah, that sounds about right.
He's mad about his portrayal. Bad.
Yeah.
Brad.
Yeah. Yeah. I was a moron.
Did he do all 10 years in prison, or?
He's out. That's why I was able to write the review.
Oh, that's okay.
Yeah. Well, he's out.
Access in prison.
What a scumbag that guy was.
We mentioned the sleight of hand. You're obviously very good with a deck of cards. You've posted videos on your website, cardsharp.com. That's with a K, with some real cool sleight of hand. But you say it wasn't really used in these games other than to deal DiCaprio aces, right?
Oh, yeah. Now, that was like during dinner, and half the people were at the table, and it was kind of more for fun than anything else. He didn't need to, man. I wasn't going to rock the boat with a game like this. You work your whole life to find a game like this. And I can tell you, Mike Sexton will tell you that. Any guy who's ever played in that game will tell you there'll never be a game like this, And I understood how special it was. But I also wasn't going to write this book and not tell the truth about my past. Because I have played in Fast Company, from the time I was really young. And, you know, when I first got out to LA, one of the probably the third or fourth game I ever played in was just like a house game. And it's the reason I had gone to the Hollywood Park in the first place, because everyone had started playing Hold'em and I just kind of wanted to learn it. And, you know, I dealt in some fast company and did some things that, you know, I was probably going to keep secret my whole life. But I thought if I'm gonna talk about, you know, the truth, then I need to tell the whole truth. And that's, you know, when I decided I was going to tell about my past and what I can do with a deck of cards, you know. Believe me, it was tempting.
You never showed Toby a trick or anything?
No, never once. Never once. And you know how hard that is for a guy who can do what I do with a deck of cards?
Man, I know one trick and I show it to everybody I meet.
And let me put it this way. If I did, I would probably show that trick. It would be like a trick that, you know, that's just, you know, looks like it's the one trick, you know. That's one of the hardest. Even Erdnase writes about it in Expert at the Card Table, you know, in the first chapter. He writes about it. It's the downfall of a great mechanic is that need, that desire to show off. And
the prestige.
Right, the prestige. But I spent my life looking like I shuffle the cards like a normal guy, you know, looking like I deal the cards like a normal guy. And I had done that for so long that if you asked me to do some fancy flourish or something, you know, I had like, that was just ingrained to be out of my system. I never wanted to, you know, make it look like I was any different than anyone else with a deck of cards. And I had already kind of mastered the ability to do that before I ever met Toby. And, you know, but there was some nights, there was some moments, I'm going to say where, you know, I may have, sped up what would have just been the ultimate, ending to something anyway. I might have helped put a bullet in the brain when somebody was dying from an open wound a couple times just to get it over with, like in a heads up situation or a side game situation. But, you know, never deployed, you know, like a deck switch or any big mechanics in the game. And we did everything we could to make it, you know, run very, very square.
There were a couple poker pros that you said in the book, made their way into the game, but you didn't name them. Would there be people we know or just guys at the time?
The first pro that tried to make it, it was funny. It was when we were at the Viper Room and Lane Flack showed up like with a bag of cash. And he didn't even make it back to say hi to us. And I'm friends with Lane, you know? So it was just, you know, someone came, the doorman came, but yeah, it was Lane Flack and he had a bag of cash and we were like, tell him to go away.
So they couldn't even come in and watch.
I mean, you know, we didn't want to, here's two things that were wrong with that. Okay. Poker was getting big on television. So a lot of these guys we were playing with, they were kind of fascinated with poker from watching it on TV. Right. So we didn't want them wanting a bunch of pros to come in all the time to play with the pros out of this fascination. You know, we were taking care of that with the celebrities.
Right? Yeah.
And, you know, so yeah, we kept the pros away, but there were a few guys, like Phil Ivey came to the game one night and, you know, I mean, he's so good. It was just kind of like a, you know, honor, you know, it's like letting him play at your golf club when he's not a member. You know what I mean? And he came and played and took the game for like 300 grand. And hell, he was to my right all night. He made the exact same raise all night long, the exact same amount. And I just waited. I finally pick up two jacks. He made that exact same raise. I popped the hell out of him. He re-popped me, we pushed, and he had aces. All night I waited. And all the other times he was showing like 8-6 offsuit and, you know, crap like that. So
and after that, they were like, no more pros.
Yeah, then Hellmuth played one night, and Hellmuth crushed it too. You know, a lot of people give Hellmuth a bunch of crap about his cash game. Let me tell you where that guy can crush it. You put him in a cash game with amateurs.
Yeah.
He chopped it up real good. You know, Andy Duke had even told me about that about him once, that she said that Phil probably plays weak players better than any other pro she knows.
A lot of people have said that about Phil, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. He knows how to play a weak player really, really well. And yeah, we didn't want to have a lot of that going on. You know, they were basically taking money out of our own pocket.
Let's do this. I'll name a celebrity that you played with, and you rate them on a scale of 1 to 10 on their poker skills.
Okay.
Ben Affleck.
Solid 8.
Okay.
Are we talking celebrity poker skills, like celebrities versus celebrities, or just poker skills, period?
Let's say how they rated in the game.
Okay.
That you played, because obviously a lot of these guys, you know, they're not going to be able to hack it at Bobby's or no matter what.
Okay, then I would say that Affleck was definitely, you know, up there, at least an 8, if not 8.5.
So if Toby was a 10, right?
Toby's definitely a 10.
Okay. What about Pete Sampras?
5.
Okay. 4. What about Rick Fox?
Probably about the same. Yeah.
DiCaprio.
I don't know. I never saw him play anything but Aces and Kings. How do you rate that?
You know, you had a funny story in the book about touring DiCaprio's house and how all he wanted to do was tell you about all the stuff he got for free.
It was so funny. He's like a... You know, in my opinion, I think he's one of the most talented actors of our generation or the past few decades for sure. But
my wife has a crush on him.
Who doesn't? Like my buddy was out with this hot girl one night, and then he shows up to have a drink with me later, and the girl's no longer with him. I'm like, what happened? He's like, DiCaprio came into the bar. He's like, she left with him. He's like, what are you gonna do? I would get mad, but it was DiCaprio. You know, but Leo was, he was real giddy because he's like, check this out, man. He's pointing out all of his furniture. And he said, so Giorgio Armani is going to reupholster all of my furniture in custom Armani leather. And I didn't even know such a thing existed. And I'm like, really? That's cool. He's like, yeah. And all I got to do is wear an Armani suit to 3 different events. And that's all I wear anyway.
Oh man, the rich get richer.
Yeah.
All right. What about Matt Damon?
Oh, Matt was down there. That was a bummer. You know, Matt was like a 2.
Isn't that disappointing?
I know.
He's not that good of a player.
But such a good guy, you know, such a good guy.
And I mean, he was Mike McD. You'd think he would be. There's a funny YouTube clip of him on ESPN trying to act when he had the nuts, and it's hilariously bad. Everyone should pick it up. David Schwimmer of Friends. You played with David Schwimmer.
Yep, played with Dave. Yeah, he's frustrating to play with. He's kind of like there's a guy like him in everyone's home game. Like the guy who, he really is the guy, the dude from Friends. Like that's
Ross.
Yeah, he is Ross, you know? And I mean, hell, Ross is a lot of fun to watch on Friends, but you know, if you're actually like, if that was one of your buddies, it'd be annoying. You know, he takes forever to make a call, and he played. I think Annie played in the same game that I played in with him one night, and she told me that he got so frustrated because she kept ribbing him, and I think he left early, and she told him not to let the door hit him on the ass on the way out. But yeah, he was, you know, the game I played with him in, it was a really cool game at John Landau's house, who's Jim Cameron's producing partner.
Well, I was going to ask you, because there's two John Landau's, the music John Landau and the movie John Landau.
Right, right. The music, that's Springsteen's manager or whatever?
Yeah, the guy who is the head of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah. No, John Landau, the Oscar winner for Titanic and producer of Avatar.
Avatar, yeah.
and a really nice guy and a good poker player. But they would play all these crazy games. Like, you know, Schwimmer didn't like the rules to all the other games, so he made up his own rules, and they called that game Schwim Sauce. You know, it was like some, it was like friggin', playing Omaha with five cards or some crazy thing like that, you know?
They got that now. Five card Omaha is popular.
Sure it is.
What about Todd Phillips?
Todd was a good player. Todd, I thought was, I had actually played with Todd before we, came together in, you know, the social setting of our private game. Todd had been down to the Hollywood Park a few times and we sat next to each other and played. I didn't really know who he was back then, but he would come with his agent and we didn't talk about business, but I remembered him once I had met him later. And, Todd was a good player. Yeah. He knew what he was doing.
What about Hank Azaria?
I think Hank was a pretty solid player too. You know, I mean, Hank was, he had his own game at his house and, you know, he'd invite an interesting array of people over. And, if you were lucky, you got to hear him do all his impressions, which were just hilarious. But you know, he was, like, I don't think he was on, at least when I was playing with him, he wasn't like on Affleck's level yet, you know, but he was a solid player and he played a lot of tournaments and stuff.
Yeah. He still shows up at the series. Pretty solid. What about Don Cheadle? I heard he's pretty good.
So I got a Don Cheadle story. I'm at the Playboy Mansion in this, I forget why it was some kind of poker charity thing going on at the Playboy Mansion. And John Moonves, who is, Les Moonves's brother, who's like a big power broker out of, LA. He's made it to the TV tables on the World Series.
CBS.
Yeah. Yeah.
CBS.
Yeah. His brother used to run CBS before all the, you know, before they found out he had a blowjob button in his desk or whatever. And with the, you know, the big movement where everyone got ousted. Mm-hmm. But John, you got to be one of the nicest, most respectful guys I've ever met in my life. And a hell of a poker player. And he, you know, he had, turned me on to a lot of these guys like Hank. And anyway, I ended up at this thing with Cheadle, because of John. And, at one point, John's playing my cards because I was out like getting a drink and nobody seemed to care, you know. And then John comes up and he said, "You got aces. I wondered if you wanted to play them." So I went back and I started playing them. And you know how these charity things are. They move the blinds up real fast, right? So before I know it, I'm at the final table and it's me and Don Cheadle and a bunch of other dudes. And I look down and I pick up pocket kings and the blinds are going up quick enough where I ship it. Family pot. Everyone at the table calls. And Cheeto wins it with, I think it was Queen Jack. Jack, and he won the tournament that night. So I don't know how good Cheeto is because that was my big moment playing with Cheeto. He didn't come to our game on our private game.
What about Nelly? Because Nelly's performed at a bunch of like Poker Stars events over the years, and
yeah, the first night I played with Nelly, it was Rick Solomon was having a game out at his beach house, and what was funny is Nelly, he lost. He owed me like $45,000-$50,000 at the end of the game, and he said, "I'll have it to you the next day," and. He had a guy that was waiting for him the whole time in like a running Bentley. And the next day the Bentley showed up like at noon where I told him to be. And this dude handed me the cash and said, you know, Nelly said, "Thank you for playing."
thank you.
Yeah. So I played with Nelly a few times and, he has heart, you know, and he might, I think he was just starting then. So, you know, he looked like one of those guys that could get good at the game if he wanted to, you know.
All right, it's time. We have to talk about it. The biggest pot you ever won or lost.
All right. The biggest pot I ever won or lost. The biggest. Well,
I mean, you hinted to it earlier, the Rick Solomon hand.
Well, I look at them as knights. There's pots and then there's knights. Oh, you know? Okay. So Rick Solomon, I ended that. That was $1 million loss that night. And the final pot was probably about $500,000. And I had never lost seven figures.
Most people haven't.
Most people haven't. And it was really a rough ride home. I got home and it was my wife's birthday. It was that part in the movie was true. Matter of fact, that scene was pretty accurate, except I never threw anything at the dealer in my life. And certainly I never would have called him a party magician mechanic, which was the line they used in the film, which I think they used that after they knew that I kind of came out as a mechanic. Anyway, that was it was really tough, man. I saw my wife was in Beverly Hills at the Beverly Hills Hotel with Toby's wife, Jen. They were having a birthday brunch for her and I was supposed to go out on a big dinner that night. And my daughter, Chloe, came running in my arms, daddy, daddy. And I just like burst into tears, you know? Mm-hmm. And it was during a rough time, you know, it was like right around that 2008 crash. And, it just seemed like everything was starting to go south, you know, in a really, really dark way. And, what they don't tell you is that I won the million back in like, you know, 2 weeks. But I was now playing for Toby because Toby stepped up and, helped me cover it because he knew that my business had been suffering and I put a lot of money into my business. And the deal that I made with him was onerous, you know, he did want 50% of my wins with no exposure to my losses until he won, until the million was paid off, which it was actually 600,000 is what he loaned me, not a 4 million. I used some of my own money. And then, but then he wanted that same deal, free rolling, like for going for a year after that.
Yeah. It cripples you.
Yeah. It crippled me. And to be fair to him, he let me out of it, you know, but it, you know, it definitely, you know, made, it was a real mind, you know, bender for a while, just trying to think how I could get around it. But the wins, I had multiple nights where I was winning, I think the biggest single night win I remember is walking away with 465,000, but I couldn't even tell you how many nights I won over 350 grand in a single night in the game. There's just too many to count.
It's insane. What was the longest poker session?
We try not to go that long. I would say, maybe the longest ever would have been, you know, maybe approaching 48 hours.
Okay.
But, you know, there was never any of these like cocaine fueled 5-day sessions, you know, that didn't go down.
You know? Did the game stop when Toby had to go work or be on the set, or did you keep going, or how does it work?
Toby rarely missed a game, first of all. what was he shooting? All of Spider-Man 3 was shot pretty much in LA. I mean, I went down to the set with him. I was there for the final scene of the movie. And we were playing heads up in his trailer in between scenes, you know.
He needed his fix.
Yeah, I don't remember him ever missing a game. And that's what he loved about me, too. You know, when people say, man, why is Houston playing? He always wins. They had to put up with him winning, you know. But his answer was always like, because we've always got a guy there willing to play poker whenever we want him. He'd be like, he'd leave his family to play.
Who wants him more? All right. What was it like working with Cheech and Chong?
I think Tommy and Cheech are great guys. That whole movie was a nightmare for me. It was coming on the heels of, you know, when I'd lost everything and all of a sudden I got to cover the cost of this movie. And I had some partners that were very inexperienced, and one partner who was just like a world-class asshole. So it was a crap movie. I don't suggest anybody watching it. Cheech and Chong's animated movie.
I mean, that's got to have some watchability regardless of how it turned out. All right. What was the weirdest place you've ever played poker for money?
The weirdest place? What a great question. I would say that the weirdest place had to have been, this was in the probably mid-90s, and I was playing with some Armenian gentlemen, and it was a dirty game, and it was at this like underground like sex club in LA and there was all these like swingers and but not just swingers, it was like a fetish club. And I was like, you know, aside from being a, you know, being a sharp, you know, with the cards, I was pretty doe-eyed. You know, I mean, I grew up in the Midwest, and, you know, so I walked in and saw some crazy stuff that, you know, that I had not yet seen. And, you know, people were like having sex everywhere. And then we go back into this dark kind of area that had all this black light. And I said, no, we can't play with this black light, guys. It's, so I got him to change the lighting a little bit, and that would be the weirdest spot.
Yeah, weird, I'd say so.
Fetish sex club. Yeah.
Sex dungeon. All right. Who's the best player in that game that we've maybe never heard of? Maybe not a celebrity or.
Okay. There was a guy in this game, and if you get a chance to talk to Doyle will tell you about this guy.
Okay.
His name's Bosco. And this guy would all boss. I can't pronounce his last name because it was so long. It's like Bosco Bajivyaka digga digga dick. I mean, I've seen his name on checks and stuff, but now, Bosco could go off for a huge number, but he was scary and sly, and he never got rattled. Like if he lost a $200,000 pot, he'd just nod his head and push you the chips with, you know, he never got rattled, and he always looked like a million bucks. Like he wore these really nice suits. And the story was I had married a billionaire, like a 90-year-old billionaire, Beverly Hills, right? And I guess Bosco, he was an older gentleman, but you could tell like when he was younger, he must've been one handsome son of a gun. And he hung out with James Woods a lot. Okay. Yeah. James Woods, who also great poker player, and fun guy. But he hung out with Jimmy Woods, and he used to be, I think he was like a gigolo or something, you know, and everyone wondered what would happen. Like when the old woman died, and last I heard, he's like left the country. He's living in, you know, some beautiful island somewhere. But he used to round back in the days when Doyle played through those Texas, you know, games. That's what I heard. And Doyle knew that he was, you know, he was a good player back then. Oh. So, if Doyle hears this and he knows anything about Bosco, Bosco is, I think, probably one of the scariest players in the game.
All right.
Oh, and Bob Safai. Bob Safai was also...
You mentioned him a lot in the book as well.
Yeah, Bobby just had a knack for breaking my heart. He would, I could get all in with him and show the aces and beg him not to call, and he would just call just to hopefully hit. He called me with 9-10 on a flop that was 9-5-2, and I showed him the two aces, and he snap called. Snap called nine on
that's
the turn.
Spite. That's spite calling.
Yeah, he snap called, and then a turn just folded off another nine like it was nothing, and crushed me for $300,000 that pot. I was so hot, I had to walk outside for like a half an hour.
That's brutal. Yeah. What was your largest non-poker wager?
I had a $100,000 weight loss bet going with Big Al, and I hated it that I didn't. Mike Sexton, when he called to congratulate me about the book, he's like, "Why didn't you talk about Big Al?" And I was like, "Man, you know, I can't believe I didn't talk about Big Al because Big Al was so much fun." And do you know who Big Al is?
No, I don't.
Okay, Big Al's like all I ever known him was Big Al, but I know he was. Like partners, I think, I don't want to speak out of, I don't know if this is supposed to be known or not, but I think he had something to do with Doyle's Room when that was going. And I believe he's been on the bookie side of things. And he used to come in and he came in, he had a few drinks one night near Christmas. And he said, "I'm coming in tonight." He was from Vegas and he'd bring cash. "I'm going to bust one of you billionaires." And he just kept putting 50,000 out before the flop without looking at his cards. It keyed around to Big Al. He'd go, 50,000. And he did it like five times in a row until Alec Gores finally called him and then lost. And man, then the game just exploded from there. But what was I going to tell you about Big Al?
The largest non-poker wager?
Yeah. So I make a $100,000 weight loss bet with Big Al. And, dude, I busted my ass to lose like 20 pounds. I was supposed to lose 50, right? And I lost like 20, but I lost it pretty quick. And I just knew I was going to have trouble with that final 30. And I see him and I was like, "Man, Big Al," I said, "I got to tell you, that's the nicest thing you could have ever done for me making this bet. Man, I've already lost 20 pounds. You know, it's dropping off like crazy. I'm feeling so healthy." And he's like, "I'll buy you out for 10 grand right now."
Save you the work.
And I accepted it. And then he's like, "You messed up, kid. I would have paid you 20.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah. All right. Let's see here. What is a talent you don't have that you wish you did?
The ability to have lost that weight so I could have taken that whole 100 grand would have been
the hindsight of 90,000 lost.
you know what I one thing I wish, I wish that I was more well-rounded in Omaha. You know, it's becoming a really big game and I never liked it. It was always a bitch to deal from a mechanics perspective. And I just never liked the game, you know? But I think that game is only going to get bigger. You know, it's just not fun to watch on television, but people are loving to play it live for a lot of money.
Got to get into it. All right. Yeah. Are you superstitious at all?
Yes and no. You know, I tell myself not to be because I know it's stupid to be superstitious, but there are a few things that, you know, I don't have a lucky hat or anything like that, but, you know, sitting to the right or left of certain people, I would be superstitious about, you know.
Okay. What about, a celebrity doppelganger? Growing up, was there anybody that people said you used to look like?
Yeah, I've heard some that aren't so flattering. Let's see.
Those aren't good.
No. Oh, I used to have long hair. I was in a rock band, man. So, you know, when I was younger, I had long hair and people would tell me, I heard two guys. I heard that I look like Stuttering John from the Howard Stern Show. And then I heard that I look like Steve Perry. And this is when I was, you know, younger and thinner.
That's funny because when I was looking in the book at the photos of you in the band days, I went, "Oh, I could see a little Steve Perry. I yeah, could right, see I heard, a little bit there."
I heard
which,
that.
You know, explains the obsession.
I love Steve. I never put two and two together. Other people did, but I've been told that I sound like Norm MacDonald.
Okay.
I was
right now. Right now, there's somebody in their car going, "Yes, that's it. That's what I'm thinking about."
Yeah, I was on an interview and the guy said, you know, just the way I talk or whatever, that I remind him of Norm Macdonald. So I don't know, that was flattering. I think Norm was like, had something to do with being the original inspiration for Rounders or so. You remember that?
I did not hear that story.
I think there was something to do with Norm Macdonald and how Rounders came about. I'll have to look that up. I could be totally wrong.
I do know that Norm plays a ton of cards.
And he played back in like the old New York club days, right? I think he was attached to, or not attached, but people thought he was Mike McDermott or something like that. I don't know.
Do you have a favorite gambling movie?
Overall gambling movie, he's got to be Casino. Mm-hmm. Poker movie, definitely Rounders.
What did you think of Shade?
I could go on and on about Shade. The mistakes that they made. I mean, these guys are great card guys, right? And I know one of the guys whose hands was in the opening. His name is Jason England. He's a friend of mine. You know, we've hung out and like swapped moves and stuff like that. I think Jason and one of the other guys even kind of did a little video talking about kind of playing down some of the mistakes that the director made, saying they were paying homage to old movies. But I personally didn't buy it. The way they treated poker the way it was back in the old movies, where you know, where someone could buy the pot.
Oh yeah, no table stakes.
Yeah, I mean, I always thought that was fishy when I was watching those old movies, you know, and it was really annoying to see him do it in this movie because they could have. Really, I mean, look at the cast they had, man. They had Sylvester Stallone, Melanie Griffith. Mm-hmm. I mean, they had this
Jamie Foxx.
Yeah. An unbelievable cast. And the stuff that they did talk about with the cards and all the moves and all of that was spot on accurate because these guys were deception artists, right? But they weren't poker players. And I think that is the problem with a lot of these gambling demonstrations and stuff like mm-hmm. that I see. These guys have never really sat and played high stakes poker. You know, they miss a lot of things. And Shade, as much as I love all those moves, and I think poker players should watch it just so they understand what can happen to them, you know, in a game. They got it wrong. Poker players will get annoyed at the inaccuracies in the poker. So,
well, here's my message to poker players. You should be annoyed by every poker movie. Nobody gets it 100% right. I mean, even Rounders is a little cheesy in spots, you know.
There's spots, yeah. But they managed to get there. And, you know, Rounders is going to seem maybe a little more cheesy as the years go by, right?
Of course, yeah, yeah. As strategy changes and
but
tells become less of a thing,
because you know, look, there's other great movies like you know, one of my favorites is Redford in The Sting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Redford and Newman. I mean, The Sting, all those great cons and that great poker scene, you know, where they're doing the holdouts and the switchouts, you know. That kind of stuff went down all the time. And a lot of poker players today, these young guys, they look at that and laugh like that could never happen. And little do they know.
Yeah.
That stuff happens every Saturday night, every Tuesday night. You know, my message to these young guys out there who think that they can't be cheated in a home game is just do your homework a little bit, because all it takes is one guy who's, you know, a little bit has some ingenuity and he's creative. And he thinks you're looking the other way, and you know, and they're smart about it. They don't fleece you for everything. They just drain a little bit of the time, you know. And there's guys doing that all the time. So you need to be armed with a little bit of knowledge when you walk into these games, you know. And you know, there's certain things you can do to ensure that your game won't get cheated. And I would say for anyone who wants to learn those things, they should go to my website, go to cardsharp.com, and check out some of my videos and subscribe, because I'm going to be, you know, really showing people how to protect themselves in their home games and how to look mm-hmm. out for cheating that can happen anywhere.
All right. You mentioned Journey. What's your favorite album? Maybe not necessarily Journey, but favorite album of all time.
Man, I haven't asked that in a long time. But favorite artist of all time, maybe Tom Petty.
Okay.
His Wildflowers album. Journey Escape, maybe. I mean, I love Journey. They're one of my favorite bands of all time. You know, I think that was a great record. It was a great record.
All right, go ahead. Sorry.
No. You know, then I've got like favorite country albums, favorite. But
we can go genre by genre. That's okay.
Yeah.
We end the podcast the same way every time with a question from the random question generator. You ready?
I don't know. Am I? Let's do it. All right.
What is your favorite sport?
My favorite sport to watch.
Is it downhill skiing?
That's a good one. That's a good one. My favorite sport to watch would be basketball. My favorite sport to play would be what is the sport with the least amount of physical poker. Yeah, I think that's what
poker. I was about to say curling, and then I remembered poker.
Yeah, I love watching a good basketball game or boxing and MMA too, man. I love a good fight.
What about sports bets? Did you ever get into that?
Let's just say I've been around it at some very, very high levels, like with some major sharps. But maybe because of my knowledge of it, stayed away from it.
Okay. So one area you didn't venture into, huh?
Yeah. Cause you gotta make a lot of commitment. Guys who are really good, you know, it's a huge commitment. And I don't think I was prepared to make that kind of commitment. So I just stayed away from betting it altogether.
Perfect. Perfect. Well, Houston, I want to thank you so much for coming on the podcast and sharing the stories.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Have
buddy.
A good one, man.
All right. Talk to you later.
That's it. That's the show. Thank you once again to Houston. I want to encourage all of you listening to go and check out Houston's book, Billion Dollar Hollywood Heist. And learn more about what went on in those games that we'll probably never see again. If you like the stories on this episode, trust me when I say that there is plenty more in the book. Like the time one of the Olsen twins came to the game. Or his brother-in-law, who just happens to be on the TV show The Office. And of course, you'll want to hear about how he ended up in jail after a bad run of cards at the blackjack tables in Las Vegas. If you want to read more details about Houston's million-dollar loss to Rick Salomon, you can check out an article about it, along with Houston's other columns on cardplayer.com. You can also follow him on Twitter at Houston_Curtis. And don't forget to check out his website, cardsharp.com. That's cardsharp with a K. And it's also the name of his YouTube channel, which features examples of his card mechanic skills. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already done so. And if you would be so kind, please give us a 5-star rating and consider leaving a nice review, which will help this podcast get in front of more people. Let us know you did it with an email to pokerstories@cardplayer.com, and we will give you a free digital subscription to Card Player Magazine. Thanks for listening.